Welcome back to the Interlude Podcast. You are listening to episode 160, A Conversation with Dr. Shiva Gofrani. Dr. Gofrani is a board-certified OBGYN with 25 years of experience in private practice. She herself has navigated several gynecologic and reproductive issues, miscarriages, endometriosis, and ovarian cancer. She uses her personal experience to shape how she practices medicine, how she educates, how she counsels. And she also has a robust social media profile where she does so much incredible education for women's health. One of her main goals is to help people eliminate their fears by being proactive, not paranoid. And I think the way that she does it and the way that she addresses the fear mindset surrounding health issues. On this episode, we talk about all of it. We talk about her experience with ovarian cancer diagnosis, treatment, life after cancer. We talk about ovarian cancer in general, why the screening is not great, symptoms, hormone replacement therapy, and gynecologic cancers, what happens at a gynecologic exam, and why you still should be getting a pelvic exam even if you're not getting a pap smear. We talk about how we think about decision-making and, again, taking the fear out of some of the health choices and decisions that people make. This episode is so full of just incredible information. I learned a lot myself, and I know that you will too. Let's get right into it. It is my honor to welcome Dr. Gofrani to the Interlude Podcast.
I'm your host, Dr. Eleanor Toplinski, and I am a board-certified medical oncologist specializing in the treatment of breast and gynecologic cancers. I started the Interlude Podcast as a way to share the journeys and experiences of women who are going through cancer. On this podcast, we talk about anything and everything related to the cancer journey, the treatment, and life after cancer. As a reminder, the information discussed on this podcast is not meant to serve as medical advice. Any specific medical questions should be directed to your healthcare team.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Doc. It's so good to see you.
So tell me a little bit about who you are, what you do, all the good stuff.
I mean, I have to tell you, first of all, I want to give a quick background that you and I met last year at a conference, a female physician conference, Pinnacle. And I was like, she seems like she knows so much about everything. And so when you invited me here, I was so excited. So I'm Shiva Gofrani. I'm an OBGYN in private practice. This is actually my 25th year, which is still very hard for me to believe because I jokingly think like I'm much younger than I am. And I also kind of say that I've had this laundry list of medical health issues that are largely OBGYN related between miscarriages and endometriosis and ovarian cancer and HPV, among other things. And it's really helped inform me not only as to how I want to approach my own health and my own, you know, transition into how much I work and things like that, but also how I engage and empathize with my patients, because I jokingly say it gives me street cred now, because if I encourage patients to do certain tests or to pursue certain things, they feel very much like, okay, she found hers, therefore let's really listen. So that really frames who I am as a physician. And in the last few years, I've made a little bit of a transition out of being in the office as much as I had been before. I'm still in private practice and still on call and delivering a lot of babies and doing surgeries, but less so in the office, so that I can be on social media and on my own platform, really trying to educate like you are. I think that you and I know so much of medicine is broken because the doctor-patient relationship ultimately is fractured, regardless of the technology and all of the advances we've made in medicine. We don't have enough time with our patients. So I think that what you and I both, I think, want to do is educate people preemptively so they can go into the doctor's office during these short visits and have enough knowledge to not need the doctor to educate during that period of time, because most doctors don't have the time, or frankly, don't necessarily have the personal experience to be able to gently say, oh, I'm not worried about you, but let's get these tests done in a certain way that doesn't scare patients. So I think that's kind of the crux of who I am, ultimately.
I agree with, you know, all of that. And I just want to make two points. One is, you know, you had posted a couple of weeks ago something that I want to stress here, because I've really taken it to heart, and you separated the difference between concern and worry.
Oh, I love when people listen.
And I
Yeah.
love that because you're right. I think oftentimes we say, you know, I am not worried, but I'm concerned. And I think just taking an extra 10 seconds to elaborate on that statement, you know, or why
Yeah.
I'm not concerned, I think helps people really understand it,
Yeah.
and recognizes something I should be, you know, really nervous about, or we're just being, you know, precautious. But you know, the other thing you said about, you know, the power of social media, and I think social media has some bad, and but it has a lot of good. And I saw someone in the office this week who came in and said, "Well, I watched all your videos. I know I need tamoxifen. I've learned about the side effects." And so the conversation was so much, I think, more fun.
Started.
She got it started at a different point, so she was able to ask, you know, you just come in a little bit more prepared, right? And the more prepared that we can be, and I think doctors, you know, as we all know, don't have time. I mean, and
Right. And it's not our fault. I mean, I say all the time, like I will absolutely absorb the times where we need to accept culpability. There, it is a patriarchal system that has really, really harmed patients, in particular women. That said, doctors are we are victims of the system as well, because we don't, you and I both know, we don't want to spend 15 minutes with our patients. We want to spend an hour and be able to impactfully educate, calm them down, emotionally connect, and also medically tell them the things that we think they need. But there's not time for that. And so I agree with you. I think social media can be terrible, but thankfully there are some really wonderful things. You and I would never have really connected if we hadn't met through social media and these.
And all these doctors, I think the other really cool part is all these doctors are learning from each other. And there's so much stuff about menopause that I have no training in whatsoever. That is, you know, and I feel that in by following all these amazing women, and there's men too, but I think there's this trend of women, right, on social media, and we've all connected, and you really learn so much that you can counsel patients better. I mean, we'll talk about this with vaginal estrogen, but the different formulations of estrogen, the better ones to use, I learned that through you guys, you know, and
No, and it really makes a difference. Yeah, good.
good. So let's dive in. So tell me a little bit, you know, about your own story with ovarian cancer, what that was like, diagnosis, treatment.
So I want us to first, both of us, I know, feel really strongly about educating people on the screening tests that they actually have. And what I say all the time to people is, when you come to the gynecologist, let's tell you what you're being screened for. You're being screened for your breast, typically either by a breast exam or a mammogram, depending on your age, maybe other supplemental tests, again, based on age or risk factors. You're being screened by the doctor looking at your vulva and doing the Pap smear, but the Pap smear is only for your cervix. It's not for ovarian cancer. It's not for uterine cancer. It's not for anything other really than cervical cancer. And that's so important, because you and I know that our patients believe when they walk out of the gynecologist's office that, oh, my reproductive organs are all fine because the doctor said everything's okay. And again, it just goes to the fact that we don't have time to explicitly say all those things. So I want everyone out there to know, you are not getting screened for ovarian cancer because there is no screening for ovarian cancer. It's not because your doctor doesn't care. It's for a lot of very technical reasons. The ovaries are small. They have to grow pretty big in order to really show up. There is no test that can easily access them. So that's really important for everyone to know. I say that because all is not lost. And that whole rhetoric of ovarian cancer being the silent killer really gets underneath my skin, because I think it allows people to just systematically never think they have any agency over finding ovarian cancer, which is why we're consistently finding it at stages 3 and 4, where it's much less survivable. So, luckily, because I knew that and I know the signs and symptoms, which in a nutshell are bloating, pain, pressure, if they last for more than 2 weeks, they are likely nothing. But they should be evaluated. And the best way to evaluate is a pelvic ultrasound, ultimately, not a pelvic exam, because that's not a sensitive enough exam to pick it up. And so, as luck would have it, I was having a lot of pain that I really believed was my endometriosis that I had had when I was younger. And nonetheless, because it was so painful, I went to my ultrasound tech in my office. She did an ultrasound and she found a 4 centimeter ovarian cyst that looked very much like endometriosis. But she said to me, I know you, and you would send your patient for an MRI just to confirm that this is just an endometrioma. And so I kind of begrudgingly said, okay, I'll do it just to prove to my patients. You know, I really feel like if you and I do things, then we can say, listen, I did it too.
And it was
It's a pain. I have a high deductible. I had to pay for it, but I'll do it. And thank God I did, because the radiologist, who was very astute, called me immediately, which you and I know, it's never good when you get an immediate phone call from the radiologist to say, this looks irregular. And I kind of placated him and I was like, oh, I'm sure it's not, I'm sure it's an endometrioma and nothing else, but I'll get it removed because I'm in so much pain at this point. And it had been probably 2 or 3 months of cyclic pain. And I was 46 and I called the GYN oncology surgeon who trained me, mostly because I love and trusted her. I didn't think it was going to be cancer, but I thought she's great. She's trustworthy. I love her. If it is cancer, she's the one, but we both know it's not. And she did surgery about 5 days later. And as it turns out, it was ovarian cancer, but it was endometrioid ovarian cancer, which for our listeners is the type that comes from endometriosis, which is not very common for that to happen. So I don't want every patient with endometriosis to be anxious. The downside is it can malignantly transform, as you and I know. The upside is it's slightly better prognosis, but it was stage two. I happened to also, despite having an amazing surgeon, my bladder was perforated. So I had to have a second big surgery to repair the bladder and then have a wound vac to repair the incision that opened from the second surgery. And then ended up with 6 cycles of chemo. And it was, listen, I say all the time, it sucked. It was painful. It was emotional. I had 3 kids, you know, all the really challenging things. And yet I feel really lucky that I had the privilege of being, as I always say, educated and white and a physician and an OBGYN who knew enough. And I have family and friends to support me. So I'm so happy to be able to use my story to kind of prod women to be really proactive. But I really never want my story to be that, you know, I always say, I don't want it to be like, rah, rah, you can go, girl, you can do it. I did it because I recognize my set of privileges that helped me do this easier than many other people. And I think, again, I keep saying you and I, but you and I know that many people, either through education or through race or through lack of access because of medical deserts or merely because they're single mothers, for example, they just don't have the ability to get to the doctor. They don't necessarily get treated the same way. So I really want people to understand that my ability to help educate them is not without humility. I don't want everyone to feel like she got through it and she seemed like she was great. So I'm going to try to put on a good face. It's really hard to go through cancer and chemo, you
And
know?
I think that that privilege, you know, is really important. And as physicians, right, there's this level of, I think, professional courtesy that we experience, that we get,
Yeah.
and the knowledge. I mean, I had a hysterectomy last month, and I definitely, it's this, I feel the same way, right? Like I was very fortunate, everything went very quickly and smoothly, and I did have a good recovery. But I always say, like, my recovery is my recovery and
Not someone else's.
not someone
Yep.
else's, I think everyone comes into it with a different body and different medical conditions and different mental health to begin with. And there's just so many factors that go into it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that I'm so glad that you and I have these experiences because I do think there's no way that it doesn't help us empathize more with our patients, right? When we've lived some of these experiences, it can help. That said, I think it's really good for us to remind ourselves, which I try to do often, and our patients that, you know, I never want it to be like, I've been through miscarriages, no big deal, stop your crying. I want it to be like, I've been through them and I get how sucky they are. And yet I also don't necessarily understand your experience of your miscarriages. I'm just here to kind of help support you in the ways that I can. And I do think a lot of doctors want to do that. I think that especially the younger generation, call myself younger still, we don't have that kind of stoic doctor patient. There's a, you know, and I think that that's the good news that we're able to really help our patients in that way.
Yeah, and I think, one of the things that I've realized, and especially as my experience as a patient too, is that when you go to the doctor's office, that visit is all about you, right? That's the time where it's your health, you're the priority, because I think especially as women, at any point in your life, but I think especially in that 30 to 50, so you have so many other responsibilities. You've got kids, work, and you're constantly in 20,000 directions, people needing things from you. And when you go to the doctors, that's the time to, that's the time to that is all about you. And I think it gets challenging when, in some cases, the appointments are really short, or you feel like your doctor is rushed. And so I think, I mean, it's a little bit of a broken system, but I've been trying to really be as present as I can when I'm with patients, and recognize that those appointments, even if they're check-ins, and you probably, I don't know if you still go for your oncology follow-ups, but
Well, I'm now 8 years out,
I
so I do. I actually still get my CA-125 checked fairly regularly, which is not necessary at this point, but it, you know, it's a small thing that makes me feel better, so I do.
But I think that's the key, right? There's so many things that help people feel better that maybe are not necessarily guidelines
Evidence-based
or
or guidelines, yeah.
evidence-based. And my take on all of it is if there's no harm to it and it provides
Absolutely.
peace of mind, I'm 100% okay.
I love that you do that, Dr. T, truly, because
Yeah.
I think that that, especially from a cancer perspective, and I think that's a little bit of what has been and will be lost further in our system because people don't have as much time to talk to their patients. That, I'm lucky that I've been with many of my patients for decades, like now that I've been doing it for 25 years. So I know them and they know me, and I can say, listen, here's what the book was. I say all the time, if I were on my oral board exams, this would actually be the wrong answer and I would fail. That said, I will do it if it's going to make you feel better. On the other hand, if me offering it to you is going to cause anxiety, tell me, because then I'll tell you when you really need something versus when we're just doing it to make you feel better. But in order to have that conversation, we have to have mutual trust. And I say to patients a lot, I want you to get to know us, not only so you trust us, but I need to trust you as a patient. I need to know that I don't have to do everything to kind of cover my ass, right? Meaning, the system is not really stacked in a way where you and I can just kind of go on faith. There is a level where we're being watched, and we have to be able to have mutual trust for it to really work well.
No, I agree. I think that I agree that things will, get lost if you're seeing, and I've had those experiences where I've gone to the doctor and it's 5 minutes and you walk out and you're like, what just happened? Right? Like,
Right,
this was
totally.
not a good visit. But then I've had visits where you walk out and you're like, oh, I felt heard and I felt listened to and I felt like my concerns are being addressed. And I know that a lot of people don't get that. And I do think that the more we talk about it, hopefully it at least inspires someone to maybe say, you know what, I need to look for a different, or I need to ask for these things, or these are things that I deserve and should get. But let's talk a little bit about ovarian cancer screening. There is not a good screening test, and I think that's challenging. We know it's not the Pap smear, and it's different. Like we don't have the mammogram or the colonoscopy version for ovarian cancer. And so we know that for people who are at high risk, and we could talk about genetics and how we determine if someone's high risk, then we do not, in those cases, we discuss risk reducing surgery. But what about those patients who, let's say, may have a genetic mutation or don't have a genetic mutation, have a very strong family history, and they're not ready, they're not done having kids, they're not ready to have their ovaries removed? What do we do for them?
Well, like you said, there are people who are at higher risk. So let's assume someone has a first or second degree relative with ovarian cancer. Let's assume that person has been appropriately genetically tested, which means not just the BRCA gene, but the entire panel through a genetics counselor, ideally, who understands the risks, and an updated panel. I tell patients, every 3 to 5 years, maybe even more frequently, revisit seeing your genetics counselor or your oncologist, because we know that your genetics don't change, but the discovery of new genes changes. So, assuming all that, then if you have a first or second degree relative with ovarian cancer, you are at higher risk, even without a gene. And you do deserve to, A, understand that you should be even more proactive if you have those symptoms, bloating or pain or pressure for more than 2 weeks. I would say it's like something I should put on a t-shirt. Please go see your doctor. And without those symptoms, if you are not done having babies, you could go on the birth control pill, because we know from good data that being on the pill by suppressing ovulation, if it's at least 5 years or more and not in a row, it will really decrease your risk of ovarian cancer. So that's beneficial. And if you are done having babies, removing your tubes, which would not put you into menopause because you'd still have your ovaries, we know that also significantly reduces your risk. So these are things that people can do, and they don't know that enough. And a lot of doctors don't know enough to tell them that.
And I think this term, this opportunistic self-injectomy, right? So having your fallopian tubes removed when you're having a surgery for something else,
Yes.
is really I think great, because if you're done having children, it doesn't put you into menopause, like you said, and it significantly reduces risk. We know now that a lot of ovarian cancer initiates in the edges of the fallopian tubes, and there's actually studies looking at for BRCA mutation carriers if they could do the remove the fallopian tubes early and then ovaries several years later to try to delay that onset of menopause.
Yeah, I think a really important factor that a lot of patients don't realize that I bring up is, let's say they are having a cesarean section and they are done having babies. It is very common for patients to say to me, well, I'm 100% done. I do not want any more babies. But my husband said he'll get a vasectomy and I've done enough. He should do something, which, by the way, as I joke, I believe he should do something. I do think women have done enough. They could have had one baby and they've done it. They could have just menstruated their whole life. They've done
They're
enough,
done
right?
now.
That said, this is the one time. If you're having a C-section and you are 1,000% done having babies, please consider getting your tubes removed because that is the opportunity outside of just being finished with pregnancies. It really reduces your risk. The other thing that a lot of people don't realize is many women don't want to get pregnant spontaneously, but they still want to have babies and they have frozen embryos. I mean, I'm cautiously saying that right now because on February 29th, 2024, things are going on in our world, like in Alabama. But assuming you have embryos, since many women don't understand their anatomy, you can have your tubes removed. You have frozen embryos. You can still get pregnant with those frozen embryos because the embryo gets placed into the uterine cavity. So these are a lot. I mean, I have very educated patients and they don't know this. So it's really important to bring it up with them. And all too often, as doctors, I think we think they know it. And if they didn't bring it up to us, they didn't tell me they wanted a tubal, for example, and all of a sudden we're at the C-section and no one's talked to them about it. So unfortunately, because I can't instruct every physician, thankfully we're going to reach more women and say, talk to your doctor about getting your tubes removed, either at a C-section or, like you said, let's say they're having some other surgery. Maybe they're having a hysterectomy, but they're keeping their ovaries. Maybe they're having an appendectomy for some reason. I mean, it's not always easy to do, but it's something you could bring up.
Now, do you still do any tubal ligation or tie people's tubes, or are you just taking them out at this
No,
point?
and it's so funny you say that. Last night I had a conversation at a alumni event for my university, and we've never really tied their tubes, meaning we used to, if the tube, let's say, is about 5 to 8 centimeters long, we used to remove a small little knuckle of tube, we called it, like just the middle. We would remove a couple centimeters in the middle. We would leave that, what we call the fimbriated end, that you and I know is what can lead now to ovarian cancer. And so we would leave the two ends, but the middle part we would cut out. And I think the reason it was called tying was because we would, in the old days, before we had procedures where we could either staple or burn, we would tie one end, tie the other, and then cut in the middle. But it was never that the tube was being tied where it could be untied. And to this day, people are like, well, I want you to tie them so that I can untie them in the future. Let me be very clear, we do not tie them. And even if you put a suture on it, it can't be untied. And so you should never do a tubal sterilization or what we call a salpingectomy right now, meaning removing the tubes, unless you are sure you're done, because it is not reversible. There are times where the old-fashioned way where we removed a little portion could be reversible, but the truth is it's costly and it's not guaranteed to work because your tube is already damaged. So the better way to get pregnant, if you decide that you want a baby after your tubal, is just to do in vitro fertilization, to do IVF. But yeah, so now we remove the whole tube.
And then the other question is, and I want you to clarify this, you still get your period even if you've had a self-injectable.
Yes.
I find that people
Yes.
kind of are like, wait, why do I still
Yes.
get my period?
Yes. It's funny you said that. A husband the other day said to me, you know, it's amazing that you get your period after your tubes removed. And I was like, it's actually not even remotely amazing if you understand that your ovaries are what secrete your hormones that thicken your uterine lining. And the only reason for the tube is to be a conduit for the egg and the sperm. So otherwise, it has nothing to do with your period. So we need to definitely educate better on all of these things.
Yeah, and I think, when I had shared about my surgery, I was surprised by how many people had these, questions about anatomy, and it just kind of brings to light like there is a lot of education
So
that,
much. Yeah.
needs to be happening. Now, we think about, so aside from all of those, right? Let's say you have a 30-year-old BRCA mutation carrier, a strong family history of ovarian cancer, not taking her tubes out at this point, not removing the ovaries. What do you think about pelvic ultrasound, CA-125 monitoring?
Yeah. I will say, well, you know as I do that the guidelines, in fact, just recently changed to say even if we so we'll go back. Up until recently, in high-risk patients, meaning patients with a first-degree relative, we were encouraged/allowed to do CA-125, which is the blood test, and the pelvic ultrasound. But really, we had to do it at pretty frequent intervals, like 3 to 4 months apart, because if you waited 6 months apart, that interval was too long. And a normal ultrasound now could actually still be an ovarian cancer waiting within that 6 months. And recently, because of all of the data with public health, they've decided that they don't encourage it, which I have to tell you, I'm very, very upset about. I would personally absolutely still encourage, offer my patients to have an ultrasound and the blood test every 3 to 4 months if they have a family history and or the BRCA mutation. Well, and let me clarify. If they have the BRCA mutation, if they just have a family history of a first or second degree relative and they're young, then I would not do it every 3 to 4 months because that really probably be all of your tests. But I would be very clear to them about the signs and symptoms. I would have a very low threshold for them to come in with pain. I would discourage kind of the, oh, every like maybe once a year I'll just get an ultrasound, because I think that actually lulls people into thinking things are fine and then they ignore things. But those patients really have to have a good relationship with their gynecologist so that they really, really feel like they can call, they can come in knowing it's likely going to be nothing but low threshold and high index of suspicion, as I call it, to look for ovarian cancer. Because if we find it at stage one and two, people will survive at much higher rates. And that can't be overstated. In the general population, you probably know this. People ask us about CA125 all the time. I want that blood test. And let's just be really clear again, it's a terrible screening test for anyone unless you have had ovarian cancer as a, and now it's been a marker going forward, or unless you have a very strong family history or the BRCA mutation.
Because all these markers can be elevated. I mean, I can't tell you how many people we saw elevations after the COVID vaccine that just went right back to normal, or having COVID or having the flu. I mean, any inflammation in the body can cause that marker to be elevated, any benign gynecologic conditions. And
Yep.
I think that this is the challenge with diagnosing ovarian cancer, is people are having symptoms, but they're being attributed to endometriosis, fibroids, heavy periods, IBS. I mean, and this.
And even other entities. I mean, I think all too often women are kind of, they tell themselves and they're told by other people like, oh, you're just bloated because you ate pasta. I mean, I would tell myself that, right? Like, and then here's the truth. When I drink wine and eat pasta, I do feel bloated, but that should last at most a day or two. So I try to remind my patients, don't be so paranoid just to think one day of bloating means you're dying of ovarian cancer. But don't be so brazen as to blow off 2 straight weeks of bloating and assume it's because you had too much wine. It could be, it really could be, but still check it out because the number of times it will be something dangerous like ovarian cancer is very small. But if we don't really aggressively look frequently, we'll miss it. And that's another problem with our system, right? The ultrasounds are not always going to be covered. That's frustrating. It's not the doctor's fault, it's the insurance companies, but it's a diagnostic test. And if you have a high deductible, you end up having to foot that bill, which is hard.
And I think that people go, I know I've seen, I'm sure you have seen two people jump around to multiple doctors and specialists, right? They see GI and they see this. And I think there's this fine balance of, right, not every symptom of bloating or pain is going to be cancer. And so there's this, how do we not
I
overtest,
know.
right, but not
Right.
ignore. And I think the 2 week rule is really important. And I think that this is where, again, we can't reach all the physicians, but we're seeing younger and younger cancer, and educating patients to say, I am concerned about this.
Yeah.
Why? And I always tell people, if your doctor kind of pushes back, to ask, well, can you tell me why you're not concerned about it?
Right, exactly. I love that. I mean, hopefully doctors will be listening to this, and I like beg slash implore all of the internists and GI doctors and urologists, if you see a young woman who tells you she's having bloating or pain or pressure, and you do your part, like a GI doctor, you do your endoscopy and your colonoscopy and it's normal, please tell that patient to go see your gynecologist as well. Just like if those patients see me, I make sure their pelvis is okay, and I tell them, please also see your GI doctor, because the symptoms overlap. The symptoms could be both. The symptoms often are IBS or something else. But again, I think you and I can't overstate enough how valuable it is to get it evaluated in case.
I 100% agree. So now let's talk about someone who's, we were talking about this a little bit before, but touch a little bit on, menopause and
Yeah.
early premature menopause and what we can do, and maybe some discussion on hormone therapy.
I think that one thing I really found and learned when it was, and it was 8 years ago now. So I'm almost 54. So I went through menopause at 46, surgical menopause, which technically is not early. Early menopause is anyone below 45. So I was technically not early, but the honest answer is I still was probably about 5 years premature from typical menopause. Typical menopause usually is a year. And again, a year because it's a year with no period. Sorry, typical menopause at age 51, and typical menopause is 1 year with no period. So at age 46, when I overnight woke up out of my surgery with everything gone and hot flashes that I described as anxiety running through my veins, like it wasn't just, oh, I'm a little hot. It felt like a fire deep inside that you can't explain that triggered some anxiety. And that really wasn't discussed. I love my oncologist. I love my medical oncologist, which is the person who gives us chemo like you. I love my surgical oncologist, but it really wasn't addressed very much. And in their defense, they were busy making sure I was alive, right? And we weren't talking about it as much then, and there wasn't as much social media. Now I think we can do better. And you and I can really encourage patients who go through surgical menopause, especially if they're below age 45. They not only have the right to, but medically speaking, they should be treated most of the time with hormones, even in certain risk categories where those patients are very scared of hormones, because we know the long-term effect on their bones, their cardiovascular health, probably their brain is going to be affected, not to mention their symptoms. And so that's something that you and I know we have to get the word out better to all the doctors, including oncologists, at the very least about vaginal estrogen. Like, if the one thing I could convince all of our breast oncologists is to let your patients use vaginal estrogen, because the preponderance of data is really, really how safe it is, right?
And I can't tell you how many messages. I mean, I have posted, I can shout this, like, please give people vaginal estrogen. And there are such good data. There's been a little bit of, in the breast cancer world, a little bit of hesitation, people on aromatase inhibitors, but that data is old. It's old formulations. And yet, there's so many oncologists who won't give it. And then, but I will say too, and it's gynecologists who are like, oh, I don't know, I've got
I know. Yes, you're right. I
gotten
mean, I'm
calls.
shocked at it. Yeah. It is
Like,
shocking.
I've gotten calls from gynecologists as well. I said they told them they could only take it for 2 weeks, and it's just this. And
I know.
there was a paper just published though, which I think speaks to all of this, that looks at how much education oncologists get about sexual health during training.
Oh, which is what? Like very little, if not none.
An hour.
Okay. By
Half
the way,
maybe.
that might be the equivalent of what OBGYNs get, ironically. Like, sexual health for everyone listening is not something that doctors get good training in. It's so
None.
sad. Yeah.
And the training in oncology was the sexual health training is about making sure that people get fertility referrals for fertility preservation, which super important.
Right.
We're not talking about all the things about early, premature menopause, menopause, all the things we as oncologists do to our patients, essentially,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
No, I got zero training on. I've
I
learned
know.
most of it through talking to patients and honestly, social media. I've learned a
A
ton,
ton, yeah.
a ton.
Well, and you know, the truth is, I will always want to be in defense of, like, all the sides, like in defense of the patients because they're anxious. But whenever people are like, why didn't my oncologist say something? I always say, listen, you have to remind yourself that your oncologist's, like, singular job and focus is to keep you alive from your cancer. So it is hard for you. I mean, you, Dr. Teplinsky, has to know all the chemotherapies and the changing chemotherapies and all of the side effects that are really medically relevant as far as, like, true medical concerns. Not that sexual health is not a concern, but what are we doing to keep people alive? So to also put the burden of sexual health is a lot. I really think the best way to do this would be if we had a really good multidisciplinary committee. And imagine if you in your practice could have a sexual health or just a therapist who also understood the psychological aspect of cancer along with the sexual health and was able to really counsel people. Wouldn't that be a beautiful, wonderful way to actually help people heal appropriately, right?
And not to mention, you have to do all of that, but you only have 15 minutes. So,
Right,
luck,
right.
right? Like, and so I think you're right. I mean, it's just there's so many flaws with it, but a multidisciplinary, clinic. And I think working with one of the things that I'm trying to do now is really build a referral base of doctors that, are comfortable talking about this, that are comfortable, that maybe have some additional menopause training or are comfortable talking about sexual health, so that when I send my patients, they can walk out feeling like, well, everyone's on the same page,
Right.
I worked
Yep.
out
Yeah.
with this, we talked about hormone therapy. So let's talk about hormone therapy it's a little bit more controversial in breast cancer, but let's talk about it a little bit in GYN cancer, because I think, at least from my perspective, we definitely don't utilize it enough.
Yeah, we don't. And by the way, it's still confusing in GYN cancers, less so than in breast cancer, because many breast cancers are obviously hormone receptor positive, and that's what confuses things. So ovarian cancer in particular is also somewhat controversial, because if you've had ovarian cancer, even though it's not hormone mediated, the concern is, will the exogenous hormones, even if they are a patch of bioidentical estrogen, will it trigger the cancer to come back? And most of the doctors that I spoke to said, we don't think it will, but at the same time, because mine was from endometriosis, Should I be taking estrogen and progesterone? And just to educate everyone out there, you only need estrogen alone, theoretically, for bone protection and maybe all the other side effects that we want to improve upon. And you need the progesterone only if you have your uterus to protect your uterine lining from the effect of estrogen. I have no uterus. I shouldn't need progesterone. But if I have these maybe potentially little implants of endometriosis anywhere, will they be triggered? And the answer is we don't know. So I decided, and I think this is something that I wish our patients could maturely agree with. There's rarely in medicine any one single endpoint, right? Like, I don't want ovarian cancer, but I also don't want I don't want osteoporosis, and I don't want hot flashes, and I don't want all these things. So at some point, I have to maturely decide as a patient, ideally along with a doctor to educate me, which of these endpoints do I want the least, and which ones can I potentially look for more easily? And so I net decided that I was willing to take the potentially, maybe, who knows, small risk of recurrence, because I really didn't want osteoporosis and to have a hip fracture, which you and I know is really devastating and actually not discussed enough. But just to give you like the quick list, if you had cervical cancer and had a hysterectomy with your ovaries removed, which is again not the most common thing to happen, but let's say you did, you can absolutely use hormones. If you had uterine cancer, probably you can use hormones. A little bit of it depends on the type of uterine cancer, on the stage of uterine cancer. That's a little bit of a question mark. If you had ovarian cancer, again, probably you can use it. It just depends. It's a little bit easier to describe and discuss it than it is for breast cancer, because again, we're not talking about hormone receptor positive cancers, but we are talking about cancers that have to do with our reproductive tract. So not so straightforward and easy. That said, to touch back on the vaginal estrogen, almost every single patient with a vulva and a vagina can use vaginal estrogen, because if they go through menopause surgically or naturally, or because of medication, their vagina and vulva and urethra will lose elasticity. We really erroneously, I think, use the word dry. And I think that misguides people, because then they're like, oh, it's dry, therefore I use a lubricant. Oh, wait, the lubricant didn't work, therefore I am broken. When in reality, you're not broken. It wasn't dry. You might even still self-lubricate. It was less elastic. And that is what the estrogen really can fix.
That's such an important point. And I think the other part of it that I hear all the time is, well, I'm not sexually active. And but there's, I try to explain it's a genital urinary symptom of menopause. And so you may not be sexually active, but you've told me you've had three urinary tract infections in the last 6 months,
Yes.
and so, yeah. And I like that saying that dryness is probably not the right term
Not the right word.
to use, because a lot of people don't even realize what's happened, and we're, again, I think people are not counseled
No,
enough
no.
on
And
this.
again, to any doctors listening, last night I was with a woman again who said, oh, I had two UTIs in the last 6 months, and my internist was wondering what was happening. And the patient was very embarrassed at age 50 something to disclose that they had both been after sex. And she had had sex essentially like twice in 1 year with her husband, and then ended up with a urinary tract infection. And I said, very common. And by the way, I hope your internist told you you could use vaginal estrogen. And the internist didn't. So again, to all the internists out there, if you have a perimenopausal or postmenopausal woman who is getting infections after having sex, especially, please offer them vaginal estrogen. It's so much better than getting a UTI and needing antibiotics.
And you can use that in perimenopause as well.
Absolutely. You can use a perimenopause. The three common times where people need it, well, I'll add actually four. Three common times would be perimenopause, and menopause is one. Perimenopause being that time that leads up to menopause that could start as early as late 30s to early 40s, as our hormones are changing, when our vulva and our vagina and our urethra are less elastic, even if we still get our period, that can happen. The second time would be when you're breastfeeding, because that lactation suppresses ovulation. It's one of the reasons why most women do not want to have sex that entire first potentially year after having had a baby, which is a whole nother topic we could talk about. And the third time is when they're on combined hormone contraception, like the pill. Even though they're getting estrogen systemically, it really can lead to less elasticity in their vagina and vulva, because those forms of estrogen actually kind of antagonize the tissue in the vagina and vulva. So some of our young patients, young, healthy patients on the pill, really, really suffer from it, and they get recurrent either bladder infections or yeast or bacterial infections. And no one thinks to give them estrogen. And it's safe for all of those people because, as you and I know, the absorption into the system is so minimal.
And it's such a little thing. It's a generic medication in most cases. It doesn't cost a lot. It's easy, you know, and I think some people say, well, it's messy, but there are ways, there's different formulations and things to do. And I think that just talk to your doctor because it really can make a difference. And
It can be life-changing. I mean, it sounds crazy to say that. It is the most simple thing. It can be so life-changing.
And I find people are, you know, their libido gets better a little bit. It's not painful. They want to have sex. They want to be sexually active. And that helps in so many ways for many people.
Yeah. And even those people and anyone listening who isn't, who thinks just like you had said before, I'm not sexually active. Even if it's just like when I go on vacation, the toilet paper is different than my soft toilet paper at home, and I wipe and then I get irritated and I get a UTI or irritation. Or I don't like to spin, but let's say I was spinning a lot on the bike and then everything gets really chafed. So those are also times where it really can be helpful.
And these are things that no one thinks about,
I mean,
right?
I think about it all the time, but yes, the
Yeah, but
patients
to be
don't think about
honest,
it
I
and
didn't
many
actually
doctors don't.
think about the bike part either, but
All the time.
that
I'll
is
tell you
in
one of the biggest things that I see, and I wish I could like coin a term. I see a trifecta of women who use either the Peloton or SoulCycle, right? They spin a lot. They have groomed their vulva completely bald, so they have no secretion of oil from their hair follicles anymore. And they wear thongs. And that combination somehow seems to really just expose their vulva in a way that the labia and the vulva get so irritated.
Interesting.
And they're all like benign things in and of themselves, right? I could see
Yeah.
why no one would think twice about doing them,
And you
but
wouldn't
I
like really put it together necessarily,
no,
right?
no. It
Everyone.
requires like literally seeing thousands of patients through the years and being like, I'm seeing a pattern here that is pervasive.
That's a fact. See, I've learned so much from this
Good,
conversation.
good. I love that. Good.
All right. And then a couple of things before we wrap up. What else? I want to just touch on the formulation of the hormone therapy that you recommend.
Yeah. So by and large, we know that what we used to use, which was typically oral estrogen, the most common form is Premarin, which we call synthetic, though I've always said it's actually incorrect to say it's synthetic. It's in a way the most natural because it was derived from pregnant horses' urine. But we try not to use the oral doses anymore. We know that the oral doses are what might increase the risk of blood clots because it's metabolized through the liver. So by and large, most of us really try to start on a patch or some other transdermal, meaning either a patch that you stick on your abdomen, or one of the gels or mists that go through your skin. So it's estradiol and it's bioidentical, which is the buzzword, but it's bioidentical, meaning it really tries to mimic the estrogen in our system as opposed to the estrogen that's in the pill, which is not bioidentical. That's a different chemical formulation than the type that is in our actual system. And then from the progesterone perspective, if you have a uterus or if you just need help with sleep, we use Prometrium as the brand, but it's micronized progesterone. Again, it is a bioidentical form, meaning it mimics the form of progesterone in our body. It antagonizes the estrogen so that it doesn't cause uterine cancer, which is the side effect of estrogen, but it also really helps with sleep. So we encourage people to use that at night if they need it. And even those women who have had a hysterectomy could use the progesterone if they need it just for sleep. So we really try to use those formulations when we can. It doesn't work for everyone. Some people need the oral doses, but the oral doses do have slightly higher risk of blood clotting. And more to be discussed in the future, where we're learning more and more about hormone replacement or what we're now calling menopause hormone treatment in people who have had even estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, which is not to say that Dr. Chaplinsky and I are telling everyone to go on it,
Yes.
but it is a evolving
Yeah.
conversation. It is certainly not a slam dunk, no, you cannot go on it, because we know the data was misconstrued and not interpreted correctly back in 2002 when we had the WHI study. And we know that we're learning a lot more about it now, which is great because at the expense of things like osteoporosis and how we felt, and maybe cardiovascular illness and maybe dementia, all of things that will hopefully be fixed by estrogen, we're kind of telling people like breast cancer is the one thing you have to be so scared of at the expense of all these other things. And hopefully we're learning more.
And I will say, I mean, I think as a if you are listening and you're, you know, have had hormone receptor positive breast cancer, and you know, right now it's the data is, you know, still not great. And the problem is no one wants to do a study because of the ethics of doing it. But there are, I often do feel like people feel like they're doomed, right? That they can't, they've been told the risk. And I think that there are great non-hormonal options also. And there's
Right.
ways that we can screen for heart disease and brain and you know, there's things that we can do. So I want people to not feel like,
Yes.
oh my God,
Scared of either. Right.
I can't
No,
do
I
that.
agree. I think that's such a good point. Glad you bring that up. I think on both sides, I don't want women who have had breast cancer to think, I'm screwed. I can't ever take hormones. Because by the way, maybe you can.
You can.
I similarly want them to know that if they actually can't or choose not to, it doesn't mean like, oh, Jesus, my bones are going to go to crap and I'm going to get dementia, right? There are, as you said, there are other ways. And I think that's so valuable to know and so important because, again, as I say, there's no one end point. There are multiple things to do. It also requires motivation and a level of maturity at being able to digest information and find doctors who are willing to work with you so that you can try different things. There is rarely going to be a one and done. I wish there were. God, I wish there was a
That
pill
would
for
be,
everything, right?
but
Yeah.
there's a new, what I'm really excited about is the new hormone therapy Duovie, which is
Yeah.
it's estrogen and it has the bezadoxifene, which works as an anti-estrogen in the breast and the uterus. And
I
so
know.
they're actually looking at it in DCIS, which is
I
stage
know, which is
cancer. So
great.
I think it's great. I mean, I think that that hopefully will show good things and then we can maybe feel a little bit more
Yeah.
comfortable, you know? So I think that's going to be really interesting to see where that pans out. But and we do know that in hormone receptor negative breast cancer, we're a lot more comfortable using HRT. So that's
Yes.
the thing. And I think one of the things we can end on, you know, is I guess I'll say my piece on it. I want to hear your perspective is, you know, how do patients approach these difficult conversations with doctors?
Yeah.
Right. Because I think that's the problem, right? I think people hear all these things and they want to talk about it and they're afraid to ask, or maybe they're nervous, maybe they feel like the doctor is on their way out and they had that question. So my take on it is I you know, I'd love to say I hope everyone feels comfortable enough with their doctor to ask, but we know that's not the
Not
case
true.
always, right? Or some people don't have options. They're in a rural area and they, you know, they have to go to this one hospital system and they feel stuck. But I think writing your questions down in the beginning, you know, bringing a list, bringing someone with you to the visit that you've talked to them in advance and saying, this is what I want to ask, and get those hard questions out of the way first. Because I
Yeah.
can't tell you how many times we go through the whole thing and you know, we're wrapping up. But wait, can I ask you just one more thing?
One more. I know.
And then that's the big one, right? Like
Yeah.
that's the one that we could have spent 15, 20 minutes talking about. So I think making sure you're as a patient prepared for the visit and early on saying, I know we have a lot to get through, but I do have these two things I want to talk about.
Yeah, I
And
think that's so good.
maybe scheduling an appointment just to talk about that one thing.
Yes. I was going to say, so and in our realm, it's a little different than yours, but for let's say you're seeing your gynecologist for your annual exam, which is otherwise known as, you know, your preventive exam or your screening exam. You go once a year, whether or not you need your pap smear once a year, because we didn't even talk about pap smear guidelines, right? Because you need your pap smear every 1 to 5 years, depending on age and things like that.
Every
You should
year
go
you
to
should see your gynecologist.
I yes, you should see your gynecologist every year for a couple of reasons. I say, first of all, you should establish a relationship with your gynecologist. And ideally, it is like, I go every year, there's nothing wrong, and we just chit chat and we do my little screening test, and that's it. That would be the ideal, because then when you need your gynecologist, you and she or he already have a good relationship, you have mutual trust, and then you can actually see them and talk to them. So, first of all, when you go for your annual exam, please know that this is annoying, but from a billing and time perspective, that is technically supposed to be only your annual exam, only screening, nothing diagnostic. Now, most of us bend the rules. If someone came to me with issues during the annual exam, I would absolutely address them and take care of them. But in theory, from a time perspective and a billing perspective, what would be ideal is this is your screening time. Make a separate appointment so that we really have time to talk about your problems, and that during your screening visit, your annual, we have time for me to actually teach you preemptively. That would be the ideal. So I would say for those of you who have the time, which is hard, make your appointment for your annual and ideally know that, you know what, I'm going to go back in a couple of weeks or a month and go through my problem issues or vice versa. I mean, really, wouldn't the ideal be that each of us kind of have every quarter you go in so that you've been educated, you have time, you know that you're going to be able to talk to your doctor. That would really be the ideal, right? But I think you and I agree. Just make sure that you write down your questions, make sure you ask, and make sure that you understand most doctors are not embarrassed about talking about things. And if you find a doctor who does seem very squeamish or embarrassed, and I don't want to disparage those doctors, but the truth is, I would say find a different doctor, because this is not, we do not have the latitude of being like, oh, that was uncomfortable. We should, per Absolutely. I should be able to have patients ask me anything in the world. And I should be able to be like, absolutely, ask away. And we are going to talk about it without judgment.
Yeah. And I will see, I see a lot of my younger patients who have we've gone, you know, gone through early menopause. I see them every 3 months. And you know, a lot of it, and they have said to me, I love it because we it's like this is at a point where we may not get to this topic today, but we'll
You know, they if they knew that they were coming every 3 months, yeah, I love that you do
yeah.
that.
And
That's
then you
good.
have time, right? And then you don't have to cram 6 months of something into 20 minutes, but you have
Yep.
that time blocked out on your schedule. So I think that that's something too. You can ask your oncologist, you know, can I come a little bit more often, or do you have a survivorship team that I can, you know, get plugged in with, and ask you know, ask the doctor that you trust for references to other doctors, right?
I
Who's
love that.
the cardiologist I can see? Who is the GYN I can see? Because then you know you're going to people who are maybe like-minded and are going to talk
Yes.
to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Good. So good.
Where can people find you?
I'm mostly on Instagram at Dr. Shiva G, which I laugh and joke. Shiva G has VAG in it, which that was the name I was born with. So it was apparently by design.
Destiny.
Yeah, it's destiny. So at Dr. Shiva G on Instagram, and then on tribecalledv.com, which is our online platform that my business partner and I created a couple of years ago, which right now has a pretty robust pregnancy class that I'm very proud of that really preemptively teaches people about all the things that might happen in pregnancy, normal and not normal, to help them understand, be educated, go into their doctor's visits to help them and their doctor feel calmer. And then I have a perimenopause, kind of a 1 hour perimenopause class on there. And in the next couple months, there will be a lot more. I mean, the whole purpose is to preemptively teach about everything: HPV, herpes, endometriosis, PCOS, contraception, all those things that women never learn about their OBGYN health, so that again, they can see their doctor with more knowledge and start at a higher level during that visit.
I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I love you.
Thank you all so much for listening to this conversation. I hope that you found it helpful and educational. And I urge you, if you're not already, to follow Dr. Ghofrani on Instagram at Dr. Shiva G. Check out her website at drshivag.com. Check out Tribe Called The. She shares such incredible information, and I have learned so much by following her, and I know that you will too. You can find me at Dr. Duplinski on all social media platforms. If you enjoyed this episode or any others of the Interlude podcast, it always means so much to me if you can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, because that helps me grow the show and bring it to new listeners. Thank you all for being here, and I will see you soon.